Hello, it's Wednesday, 21st of October. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bowerman from Check In Asia.
On this week's show, we're talking one thing only, travel bubbles.
Yeah, after last week's inauspicious start, we are talking the good, the bad, and the bubbly. Let's move on. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So let's talk travel bubbles, which have become one of the most used travel industry phrases of 2020.
Yeah, it really has. I mean, the media certainly picked up on the travel bubble phrase, hasn't it, and run with it at some pace. It's a very heavily discussed concept, one that's not widely understood, I think, but largely because it's interpreted and applied in negotiations in different ways. And also it's been used in the media to explain various different scenarios within travel. So, and I guess the first thing we should probably do, Hannah, is take a step back to when this idea of a travel bubble first came into the travel sphere, because it's a new word, really, a new phrase.
Yeah. Yes, it was, absolutely. So, I mean, this really originated at the beginning when we were talking about travel between New Zealand and Australia, and they called it the Trans-Tasman bubble. Can you remember how long ago that was, Gary? It was early on, wasn't it?
I actually can. 23rd of April. Can you believe it? I think that's 7 months ago, is it?
Wow. 23rd of April. And it's only just come off this week, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I remember when the Prime Ministers of New Zealand and Australia announced that this was something that they were looking to do. They were talking about COVID safety. They were looking at how both countries, island nations, sort of isolated from the rest of the world. And at that time, they both managed the virus particularly well. They both said they were on similar trajectories to becoming COVID safe. But they did say at that time, we go back to April, that this wasn't something that was going to happen soon. This was something they were talking about in future. They didn't actually state a time. But I kind of got the feeling, and I think we've both been asked this in interviews in the interim period, the expectations were suddenly quite fast that travel bubbles could be implemented quite quickly. And it obviously wasn't as simple as that.
No, I mean, I feel like we've been talking about travel bubbles for a really, really long time across Southeast Asia. And we still haven't seen a travel bubble in place, right? I mean, and I guess we should talk about what do we mean really by a travel bubble. And I think largely at the beginning, it was thought of as kind of this corridor, travel corridor, that's another one that's used, but there's a kind of agreement between two different countries or two different areas even that would allow for all sorts of travel, right? I don't think it was necessarily just tied to business travel, but also leisure travel would be included and people would be able to move more or less freely between two countries or two regions. But, you know, this has obviously got a little bit more complicated as reality has hit, hasn't it?
Yeah, I agree. I think you're absolutely right there. The original idea is that this would be bilateral agreements between two countries that had managed the virus particularly well. So it was an intergovernmental agreement. And the key points, I think, was that it is reciprocal. So it would be two ways. Countries would allow visitors from the other country and vice versa. But it will be quarantine free. I mean, the whole point was that you would remove the 14-day quarantine requirement between the two countries. And that would incentivize people to travel to another essentially COVID-safe country. And like you said, Hannah, if we go back to late April or early May when this was first discussed, I think there was a sense of optimism that, you know, COVID-19 wouldn't last to the scale and depth that it has, and that these agreements could be put in place. Now, one of the reasons that they didn't get put in place, particularly between Australia and New Zealand, was the outbreak in Melbourne, which, you know, went on and on and on. It was a very protracted outbreak. They had a very, very long lockdown, I think one of the longest in the world. Meanwhile, in other destinations, which were perhaps looking at doing travel bubbles as well, Vietnam, China, we also had outbreaks there, which sort of spooked the system a little bit, didn't it? So as well as these agreements becoming very difficult to manage in terms of the virus itself, there were a lot of political overlays as well. And also the airlines were struggling. So, you know, a key part of these bubbles, which we'll come to in a moment, is the airlines. You've got to have flights between the two countries to make them work. So there were all sorts of difficult reasons that have prevented travel bubbles from happening. But I do go back to the point I made earlier. I do think expectations were probably a little bit high that they could be implemented quicker than they actually have been.
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably goes for all kinds of travel, right? I don't think anybody back in April or May still thought that the world would be as kind of locked down and locked up as it still is. We're almost in November now. You know, and one of the things that I've been working on at the moment is a report for the Catalan Tourism Board, and I have to speak to members of the travel trade about when they think borders will reopen. So I did a report back in August, and people were saying, yeah, you know, maybe by the end of the year. Now I'm asking them the same kind of questions. When do they think leisure travel will reopen? They're saying June next year. They're saying July next year. Just that difference of a couple of months. It's just making a huge impact on just even their perceptions of when travel might open, you know. Yeah. And these guys are not the decision makers. They're just waiting for the governments to sort it out themselves. And you're right, a lot of it, I think, is down to politics as well. It's extremely political, I think. All of these different nations negotiating different travel bubbles with one another. You've got lots of general elections taking place. So, you know, New Zealand just had theirs this week. And I'm sure that Jacinda was waiting for that to happen and, you know, for her to win before she took any more gambles kind of politically in terms of opening up New Zealand further.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think one of the other overlays that has definitely come into the equation, certainly over the last month, maybe over the last two, is this idea that we've discussed this beforehand, it's vaccine or bust. You know, everybody is now looking at a vaccine hopefully being rolled out next year. But in the meantime, one of the problems that we seem to have had, and the airline industry is definitely trying to push this a little bit at the moment, is we've had these testing discrepancies. We've had these different types of tests. Some are rapid, some are longer term. But we've had these variable results in actually getting the results of each test. And that doesn't engender any confidence, not just for people to travel, but also for airlines to operate more flights, and particularly for governments to open up their borders. So, you know, although a lot of the progress this year has been definitely scientific and technical, I think we've come a long, long way in terms of the understanding of the virus and some of the necessary steps that need to be taken. You know, there's no overarching or integrated mechanisms to make this happen, particularly in Asia. I mean, we're looking at Europe and the US at the moment, and they're a long way behind in terms of their cases. You know, there's going to be very long winters in those regions. But you look at Asia in particular, and most countries are managing the virus particularly well. There are some outliers, but you know those were expected, and they're not new. But actually opening up, even between countries that are technically quite safe at the moment, the fear of the risk factor is overriding everything else, because there don't seem to be those safety nets in terms of testing and tracing that really would allow some degree of air travel to open up again.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a lot of distrust even between different governments about whether they are really able to believe the test results of the other. So, you know, you're arriving at a country with a negative test result. But would that be a negative test result if it was taken in that country? So there's a lot of difficulty, I think, with that.
And I think in addition to that, there's the use of health tracking apps. And so if you go to a different country, you probably have to download a different tracking app to the one that you're used to using at home. And are they interoperable? You know, is it going to work? I mean, you know, particularly you look at China, and their app has been extremely well developed, and it was developed right from the beginning. You do wonder whether Chinese travelers traveling overseas would trust a tracking app from another country. You know, they would probably, and the government would probably want its own citizens to use their own app. But then you've got to make sure that that could be used in the country that they're traveling to. So I think there's a lot of technical issues as well as the actual political and scientific issues as well.
Yeah, it's definitely not as straightforward as country A talking to country B and saying, right, let's do it. Is it?
So shall we have a look at, we've tried to discuss there a little bit what a travel bubble is, but as you mentioned, Hannah, in your point a few months ago, there are lots of different other types of similar agreements that have been put into place. Now, if we look at the countries that have probably been most proactive in this, in our region, we'd say Singapore for sure, Japan as well. India has also set up a number of different sort of miniature travel agreements. So let's have a look at Singapore and what they've been doing, Hannah, because they have this safe travel pass system, which isn't a travel bubble. We'll come to the Hong Kong travel bubble in a moment, but they have all these different agreements, don't they? And it is quite confusing to kind of dissemble them and what they actually mean.
Yeah, exactly. So right now they have a fast lane for Chinese and South Korean business travelers. They have a residence track with Japan. They have a reciprocal green lane agreement with Malaysia and Brunei, as well as a periodic commuting arrangement with Malaysia. And like you say, they've got air travel passes for countries like New Zealand, Vietnam and Australia. And lastly, they're talking about an air travel bubble with Hong Kong.
Yeah.
They're the masters of coming up with different names for different agreements,
I agree. I think the way to look at it is they are being very pragmatic about this, aren't they? They're not really saying, well, apart from the Hong Kong, we'll come to that in a minute. These are essentially essential travel, business travel, pass holders, that kind of visa holders, that kind of thing. And they're trying to put these different agreements in place with other countries. Japan has done something similar, hasn't it? It has a residence track and a business track programs. I think the business track is currently with Singapore and South Korea. They're apparently in negotiations or near to an agreement with China. And then the residence track has, I think, 10 countries, and most of those are in Southeast Asia. So there are these ways of moving people around, but they're not travel as we know it, and they're certainly not tourism.
No, definitely. All of these, you know, require lots of pre-registering of your itinerary. You've got to keep to very strict, you know, you've got to tell them where you're going. You've got to download all the apps, like you said. You've got to have your negative test. You've got to apply. Normally, for a lot of these business ones, you've got to be sponsored by a company as well. It's quite a cumbersome process. It's not for people who say, oh, I just need to go to Singapore for, you know, one meeting to meet someone. No, that wouldn't happen. If you go there, you've got to really make it worthwhile with all of the hoops that you've got to jump through.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So let's come to one of the big announcements. We did discuss this briefly last week, which, you know, has engendered so much hope across the industry. And this is called an air travel bubble. This is the one that's sort of made us sit up and think a little bit. And this is between Hong Kong and Singapore. Now, this was announced last Thursday. We don't have too many new details yet. The press are coming up with bits and pieces of speculation. But the concept of this, Hannah, is very different to what's come before.
Yeah, it is. Because this one is actually a reciprocal air travel bubble, in that it's for leisure travel, it's for business travel, it's for any kind of travel, in fact. But there are no restrictions on your travel itineraries, on your travel purpose. You don't need to quarantine. You don't need a stay home notice. You just need a negative test prior to your departure and fly on a dedicated flight for that bubble. So it's very different in the fact that Singapore has had, you know, it has opened up the country to certain travelers who don't need to quarantine, you know, New Zealand, Australia, except Victoria State, Brunei, Vietnam. But it's not reciprocal agreements, those ones. They're very much one-sided. Singapore is opening up to them, and they're not necessarily letting their citizens out or accepting Singaporeans in. But this one, you know, it gives hope, because it's really a reciprocal one. It's for leisure travel. It could potentially allow, you know, mass leisure travel, which is something that has not been heard of since February for Singapore. It's really, really positive. But of course, you know, it's still in agreement. There's still no date set yet for when it will start. So there's still a lot of question marks about it. Not least things like flight connectivity. How much is a flight going to cost? How much is a COVID test going to cost? But one thing that I have noticed about Singapore, and we keep saying this before, is that they're pretty pragmatic, they're pretty practical in how they're approaching this, in that they've now started to set up more clinics where you can go and get a COVID-19 test for pre-departure. So before this point, it was actually quite difficult to be able to obtain these tests. You had to, I think, actually have been suspected of COVID to get it, or you had to jump through a lot of hoops. But they're realizing you know, this is a crucial step, that we need to firm up this and allow, you know, open up more clinics, allow more people to to get tested before departure if we want this to work.
Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine in Hong Kong yesterday. He's in the travel industry, and he was saying that a few of his friends have actually booked flights to Singapore for New Year's. They're going to go there. They said the flight prices were quite high. But he said that one of the issues that a lot of people, like himself, he hasn't yet booked. He said he wants to go. But he said one of the issues that's putting him off at the moment is there's a lot of speculation now that one of these issues is, you know, the agreement was announced, but the full details haven't yet been rolled out. And he said there's a lot of speculation about the number of COVID tests that people will have to have. And in some cases, that it's being suggested that might be four. And so four individual tests will be quite expensive. So he said that's actually putting people off at the moment from they're just waiting and seeing before they book. And also, I presume that's the same for the airlines. They're not adding in any extra flights at the moment because they don't quite know what the requirements are going to be on travelers and how that will actually affect the demand about people, whether they're going to travel or not.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's just all a wait and see, isn't it? And I think that the governments need to, now that they have kind of teased everybody in a way with this announcement, I think that they just need to hurry up and get it in place. Because I think another issue that I was, like you said, for especially for Hong Kong, is the tests are not cheap. So they need to be able to rethink, you know, what should the ceiling price be for an RT-PCR test as well, just to ensure that if they are opening up, that they can make it affordable and it's feasible for people to travel.
Yeah, I mean, as we said right from the beginning of this show, Hannah, there are so many things to discuss. And when you actually announce that this is going to happen, you know, you can imagine the amount of negotiating that's going on, because there are a lot of technical details actually just involved in taking people from A to B and then back to A again.
There are. And that probably leads us kind of nicely. So should we move to this Trans-Tasman bubble?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I like you said, I think that there are a lot of negotiations and things that should be considered, I suppose, before these travel bubbles take off, pardon the pun, but that have not necessarily been considered, right, for the Australian and the New Zealand travel bubble.
Do you want to explain? Well, the tricky one with Australia now is, When you look at, let's take a step back. When you look at Singapore and Hong Kong, two city states, not huge. They both have one airport. Relatively easy to manage, you would think. Okay, there's a lot of technical details, but it shouldn't be that difficult. When you look at Australia and New Zealand, you have very, very different geographical and political systems. So New Zealand is you know, it's ruled from the centre. It's a centrally administered country. Australia isn't, it's a federal country. So although there is a central government, a federal government, each of the states has their own powers on so many different things. And one of the things we've seen over recent months, and this has become extremely controversial within the country, is that each state has control over its own borders. And so a lot of the uproar in the country, because the country is moved through spring and it's now moving to the summer season, there's going to be no international travel for the foreseeable future, but there is every chance that Australia could really rebound its domestic travel season, particularly over the next few months, over the summer season. But some of the states have been very, very resolute that they're not opening their borders to specific other states, particularly Victoria. Victoria's been the person in the middle here because it had this huge outbreak. But obviously Victoria has some agreements with other states, and therefore those states can't have agreements with other states. It's got extremely political. So the problem with this Trans-Tasman bubble is, because of the Victoria outbreak, it couldn't be a two-way bubble. It's, at the moment, it's only a one-way bubble. So it's residents living in New Zealand can fly to Australia. Now, at the moment, because of these different issues in terms of the state borders, they can only fly into two states. They can fly into New South Wales, which is Sydney, or they could fly into the Northern Territory in the north, which would normally be Darwin. Now, what happened this weekend is, last Friday was the first flight from New Zealand from Auckland to Sydney under this agreement. There were more flights over the weekend. And what happened is there was conflicting information about the New Zealand travelers coming into Sydney. And a lot of them actually traveled on into other states. There were 65 travelers went to Victoria, which is not part of the travel bubble. Others also went on to Western Australia, to South Australia, and also to Tasmania. And this has, again, just infuriated this uproar about border control in Australia. because there was actually conflicting information about whether these New Zealand travellers were actually permitted to do that. And there weren't, in Victoria in particular, any state rules that prevented them from doing so. So the Victoria Premier has been arguing with the federal government, saying, actually, you've said that this is just a bubble for two states, but essentially it's not. It's a bubble for New Zealanders to come into any part of the country. And this has been hugely, hugely controversial, to the point where South Australia has actually said today that it is going to join the bubble. It's going to allow New Zealand travellers to fly direct into South Australia, which would be Adelaide. So this one is going on and on and on. But the problem, it seems at the moment, is there's this slight resentment that New Zealanders can come to Australia, but Australians can't go in the other direction.
Interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that perhaps illustrates the issues of thinking about setting up a country to regional travel bubble, which is, you know, when we said we started at the beginning of this, travel bubbles were thought of as country to country. That's kind of straightforward because, you know, you've got the borders of that country and then you know where people are going. But then, you know, a few months later, people started to talk about, oh, perhaps we should be doing these travel bubbles to green zones instead, right? Green zones or safe zones or green states. And that's the issue, isn't it? It's how do you then control that movement domestically? And often you can't. And it's really difficult. What's to stop other people from going to other states once they've entered the country? Very little. Or from, you know, people, for example, who, let's say Penang in Malaysia is a green zone, they go up to KL, which is a yellow zone, for a week, you know, weekend holiday, go back to Penang, and then they fly off somewhere else. And they're allowed to because Penang is a green zone, so they can fly from Penang. You know, there's so many issues, I think, when you start looking at zones or regions to countries rather than country to country.
100%. I think one of the things that, you know, that we said right from the outset of the show, Hannah, is that there were so many difficulties in setting up these bubbles in the first place. And obviously governments were watching these. But, you know, travellers are used to not just flying point to point. You know, we always fly into one city and then we transit onto another. It's almost become second nature. And even though, you know, we've had this virus, you know, that's still the mindset that people think when they're travelling. And it's quite difficult then to actually implement that at the airport, because you're then putting the pressure on the airport management, the customs officials or something. And if they don't have the powers to actually manage that, you know, this is all part of the agreement that has to come in right from the beginning. You can't really blame the New Zealand travellers. You can't really blame the airport staff or the customs staff, because they didn't really have the powers to change any of this. And, you know, I would imagine that anybody negotiating a travel bubble around the world right now is taking stock of this, because it is quite an issue. Now, the problem, I think, in Australia is one of state politics. It's not so much a worry about the virus being transmitted, because there is virtually no COVID-19 in New Zealand. So it's a relatively sure that the arrivals are pretty safe, but it's still management. It's still management of trying to prevent this happening in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you're right. You know, it's a new thing, isn't it, for all governments. No government has really had to negotiate these kind of travel bubbles before, where it matters so much, you know, in terms of health and safety, and you slip up and it could have disastrous results. So, yeah, it's just a learning, isn't it? And I think other countries that are starting to negotiate these travel bubbles are watching all of these ones that are going on for the pitfalls, so that they can learn from them when they implement their own, if they implement them, to make sure they avoid
absolutely.
That.
The perils of first mover advantage, sometimes they're, you know, the perils can outweigh the benefits.
And so should we talk about another example of a travel bubble then? So we'll move to South Asia this time, because we don't have any other really examples within Southeast Asia. And India and the Maldives. Gary, I think you've been following this one a little bit.
Yeah, so you mentioned that it's South Asia. So this was South Asia's first travel bubble. Maldives reopened its borders to travel on the 15th of July. And it did a deal with India towards the end of August to allow some flights in from India to travel to Maldives. Now, as we've said on the pod many times before, Hannah, Maldives is quite a good case study for managing COVID, because it generally tends to be one resort on one island. You know, it's this archipelago of islands. It's very easy to isolate travelers as they come in and as they go out. So the idea was that India last year was the fastest growing market for Maldives. It's pretty close. And I think last year the number of arrivals from India was up about 83% compared to the year before. So there was this opportunity to bring in a few tourists. Obviously, India at the moment is struggling with the virus, so they're having to be very careful about the testing they do before travelers leave India. And there's, at the moment, there's only a rather small number of flights in and out of India and the Maldives. But this was an idea that it could at least grow into something over time. I think this travel bubble in particular wasn't really aimed at short-term gains. It was trying to build a market. And last week, I think it was last week or the week before, Maldives announced that it was going to do a six-month string of marketing activations across India to try and drive more confidence in travel to Maldives. So, you know, if they're expecting this to take 6 months, we probably shouldn't expect that the visitor arrivals will be huge straight away. I think they're looking for phased growth on this one.
Yeah. I mean, it's at least hopeful, I think, that it's in place. And I think, like you said, India is struggling with COVID. And so if they can get this right, and then they can show that, yes, even if you are arriving from a country that does have a high prevalence of COVID, and you're still managing to keep your own country safe, that's perhaps good news for other travel bubbles as well. Because right now, I think a lot of the mentality is that we need to only make these travel bubbles with other countries that have, you know, a similar level of cases as our country. But if they manage to manage this well, then again, it's a good case study for how that could work.
Yeah, I think Maldives has been pretty sensible in the way that it's reopened. I mean, it has done it in quite a phased way. Still, some of the resorts aren't open. Most of them are, but some of them still aren't. It has reopened in a very phased way. And actually, if you look at the arrivals numbers since July, so it opened up on the 15th of July. And if you look at the arrivals figures between the 15th of July and the 14th of August, they only had just under 27,000 arrivals. So it's not huge numbers. So they are being able to test out their management processes, work out, you know, how they can isolate people and keep these flows safe, in the hope that travel will start to scale up. And ordinarily, you know, we're moving into what would be the high season for Maldives.
So, Gary, should we play a little game at the end then? And should we think about what travel bubbles might we see in the next few months? What do you think?
Well, that's a tricky one. I don't think we'll hear any new announcements until we find out more about the details of Hong Kong and Singapore. I mean, that's sitting on the fence, but I think it's true. Hopefully that's not going to take too long, because I think there's expectations in both countries that travel might be possible over Christmas and New Year. So I think, you know, that's probably going to happen quite soon. In terms of where we're going to see more bubbles, well, I would say that the prime candidate, I don't know who with, is Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Possibly Japan, possibly Korea, maybe Taiwan. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think Vietnam is a good case for it. Like, we know, we've been talking about it, they've opened up to international commercial flights now, and they seem to be putting a bit more of an emphasis on kind of international marketing as well, which I think is potentially interesting. Singapore, I reckon it could be Singapore, Taiwan. Unless that becomes too political with China and that upsets China, which is always a possibility, I think. Thailand, I don't think we'll see any travel bubbles. We just had this arrival of these special tourist visa tourists yesterday, either 39 or 41. I couldn't quite figure it out from from the newspapers.
And nor could the journalists actually at the airport. They counted different numbers. I was watching it live last night.
But other countries, maybe we could see maybe Laos and China. I think that could happen.
That's possibly true. What about Cambodia? Do you think Cambodia?
You know, they've got so much potential because they have really contained the virus. Maybe, but I haven't seen much movement from them. I haven't seen much, you know, many hints that things are going to change there either. I mean, China again would be a prime candidate for them to open up. They account for so much of their tourism arrivals. Yeah. So if they did have one, it would be with China, I think.
Yeah. I think whatever we see for this year, it will be on a very small scale. I guess, you know, across our region, everybody's going to be hoping that something can happen for Chinese New Year, but you know, that's coming quite soon, and you'd have to wonder whether China will set up too many agreements. It may do one or two, but I would be surprised if it does any more than that.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been quite hopeful that Malaysia and Singapore would reopen for leisure travel by the end of the year, but with this new spike in cases here in Malaysia, I just don't see that happening now anymore. No, not until next year.
I think that's very unlikely. I would agree, and I think, you know, that shows just the problem of bubbles. You know, a month ago, I think we were both quite positive that that could happen, but look at what's changed in a month.
Yeah, absolutely, everything. Everything changes on a flip of a coin. So that brings us to the end of this travel bubble edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. We hope you enjoyed the show. And as always, we'd love to read your feedback on what we said or what we missed out. So email us at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com and look out for our daily travel insights and podcast news on LinkedIn at the Southeast Asia Travel Show and Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yeah, and meanwhile, you can catch up with all 46 of our previous episodes of the Southeast Asia Travel Show and the Friday Rewind Show on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each one.
So that's a wrap for this week. We're both off to plan future travel bubble escapes. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.
Yeah, thanks very much. Bye-bye.